I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What an interesting hour we have ahead. The author of The Industries of the Future, Alec Ross, will be with us. Alec is a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University and served for 4 years as senior advisor for innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. So he traveled all over the world, and he happened to see, as he was studying innovation, some countries where he was seeing the future. He also serves as advisor to investors, corporations, and government leaders. The book, he says, is about the next economy. It's for anyone who wants to know how the next wave of innovation and globalization will impact our countries, our societies, and ourselves. He looks at a fascinating chapter on robotics. He'll make you want a certain kind of robot. I can assure you what he talks about them. Advanced life sciences, the codification of money, cybersecurity, and big data. He wrote a very interesting piece recently in the Wall Street Journal on the language barrier, which is about to fall, which is fascinating. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Alec, and here is how you reach us this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K. Dunn Show. And Alec, we thank you very much for being with us. This should be fascinating. Hi.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be on.
Yeah, great to have you here. Well, I want one of those robot baby harp seals.
Right?
Yes,
you know,
right.
Some of these, I'll tell you what, the robots of the cartoons and movies of the 1970s, I think, are going to be the reality of the 2020s.
Oh, my goodness. This whole chapter on robotics is fascinating because with the good, there's the problematic, which is a theme that runs through much of your book. But robotics can help many of us, particularly do all these things for us or help us as we age, because so many of us are aging.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. The robots that are being developed for elder care are being developed in Japan right now, and they're being developed by car makers like Honda and Toyota, who are really, you know, they're good at electronics and they're good at mechanical things. And Japan is a distinct society. It is the oldest. It has the oldest population on Earth, and they're growing older. The average life expectancy is comfortably into the 80s, and they're growing older. And because there aren't enough young Japanese people to take care of the grandparents, mm-hmm. and because they don't allow much in the way of immigration, Honda and Toyota have created these robots to take care of seniors and, you know, teach them how to do things. The robots even do things like play the violin to entertain them.
Isn't that something? And Paro, this baby harp seal, who I understand President Obama had a chance to pet the baby seal, is like a pet because you want to have a company of an animal all the time if you can. But if you can't take care of the animal, he's like an animal who you don't need to, he doesn't have to go to the bathroom or eat or anything, but he's sort of like a pet.
And even has fur. So what's fascinating, you know, it's like, how can you have a pet at home if you're not really able to independently take care of the pet? And it's sort of fascinating. And it's also fascinating culturally. Like, there's a reason why these inventions are coming out of Asia. In Western societies like ours, Kathleen, you know, our mythology, our stories tell us to be wary of bringing things to life or humans trying to do things that they ought not to, mm-hmm. from Icarus's waxed wings to Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
But Asian societies oftentimes believe in animism, that even objects have souls.
Oh,
and so they don't have the cultural baggage that we do about, you know, creating robotic pets.
Yeah. Let's talk about the problematic parts of robots, which you also write about. Where are we in terms of robots replacing jobs for humans?
I'm so glad you asked that because, you know, most people who write books about the future, it's either utopian, oh, we're going to live forever and all of our needs are going to be met, or it's dystopian, you know, it's being written from the fetal position. And I really tried to write a balanced book here that, you know, brings out both the promise and the peril. And part of the peril of robotics is taking jobs that were once done by humans and having them done, you know, automation. So, you know, this is nothing new. I mean, we know lots of blue-collar labor has been replaced by robotics and automation. What's different now is that because of artificial intelligence, robots are beginning to do things that aren't just manual and repetitive. They're able to do things that are cognitive and non-routine. So like my father, God love him, and I love my father, spent 45 years working as a country lawyer in rural West Virginia. And for 40-some-odd years, what he basically did is he did the paperwork for real estate closings,
mm-hmm.
you know, creating big old stacks of paper that you have to sign 100 times, and it takes months, and it has, you know, thousands of dollars of closing costs. It's a white-collar job, but it's sort of low-level white-collar. Those are the kinds of jobs that I think are going to be wiped out next.
Mm. So a lot of people will be displaced.
A lot of people will be displaced. You know, I would love to pretend otherwise. And the question then is, what do we do about it? So let's think about agriculture. You know, so Wisconsin, obviously, you know, for hundreds of years now, been home to brilliant agriculture. In 1870, one out of every two people who were in the workforce in the United States worked on a farm. 50 years after that, it was about one in every four people. Today, it's one out of every 50.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? So what happened is labor moved off the farm, but it did find homes elsewhere. So the question is if this kind of labor is going to be eliminated, what are the people going to do? And is there going to be sort of this continued march upward in terms of our being able to do more with less, but people still having good jobs?
Mm-hmm. Let's look at this. You start with some fairly grungy kind of work that you had to do as a young college graduate until you found your place in life when you were in West Virginia. Let's talk about what has happened, and you're still a young person, but 20 years have gone by since you did that menial labor. What's happened in the world of innovation that has been striking to you, and you say that it's going to be even greater in the next 20 years. How so?
Yeah, so Kathleen, you know, when I was working as a midnight janitor in college to help put myself through school at Northwestern University, the internet hadn't even, the World Wide Web didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people didn't go on the internet, and all you could do with a telephone was make a phone call with it.
Right, right.
And, you know, and I do consider myself young. You know, I'm in my early 40s. I think that's young.
You are young. Yes, sir.
But the changes that have happened just since I left college are mind-boggling. And what I think is going to happen next is as much is going to change in the next 10 years as has changed in the last 20.
Mm.
So what I try to write about in the industries of the future is I'm trying to help people look around the corner and light a little path. You know, even though I've been really blessed, I've had a very successful career. You know, I'm at Johns Hopkins now. I've been very fortunate. I'm still at heart, you know, the public school kid who had to put himself through school as a midnight janitor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote this book, The Industries of the Future, to try to help people know now what's coming around the corner so they can prepare for themselves. And, you know, look, as a parent of a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 9-year-old, I also wanted to give parents and grandparents tools that they could use to help their kids get ready for tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you have your feet on the ground. I hope you retain a sense of where you've come from always, because that makes a difference in how you are in this world. Let's move a little bit more to some other high-tech areas. We've been hearing a lot about this, and you have statistics in the book that are fascinating. Because the average American spends 18 hours a week driving a car, that's a lot of time, that these driverless cars may be attractive to people. My understanding is that they're not quite there yet, but all the car companies are looking at them. The other place looking at it seriously, surprise, surprise, is Google.
That's right. No, it's crazy. You know, I went to Google about a year and a half ago, and I was interviewing them about this idea of a driverless car. And they said, all right, well, let me show you what the cars look like and this and that. And they told me to get in the car and buckle up. And I'll be darned if that car didn't start driving. And I thought, oh, okay, this is really interesting and a little scary.
Yeah.
But then it left the parking lot, Kathleen. And then it went on the highway.
Oh.
I was in a car without a driver.
Oh.
And I was sweating. But it worked. We were out there for about 15 minutes on Highway 101, which is a busy California highway, driving around for 15 minutes. And I got back to the Google campus, and I'm telling you, it was like an out-of-body experience. And what I took from this is that the technology can work. I mean, we aren't there yet where we want all of our cars to be driverless, you know, goodness gracious. But I was out on the highway for 15 minutes in busy traffic, and I made it back to Google. And so I do think that even though this might seem like something out of a weird movie, I think we're about 10, 12, 13 years from this kind of thing mainstreaming, and absolutely every car company is looking at it.
You were too nervous. You said you were sweating while this was happening. I can imagine that happening to me as well. But for those of us who get used to it, who aren't sweating every time we're out in there and the car is driving by itself, what are we doing instead of
we're
driving
being
the car?
So 18 hours a week spent driving. So I guess, and maybe this is why Google's doing it, maybe we'll spend more time on our phones, or maybe, goodness forbid, Kathleen, we'll have a book open.
No.
I just wrote a book, so I sure hope people have got a book in their lap and are reading a book. You know, but the idea essentially is, how do we take something that, you know, maybe people enjoy, but they may not enjoy doing it for 18 hours a week, which is driving, and turning that into 18 hours where we're doing something else. We're being productive in different ways.
And you said we're how many years away from it?
I think it's between 10 and 15 years.
Interesting. We're going to pause for just a moment. I don't know if it's a robot singing in the background or what, but we have a little bit of, you maybe aren't hearing it, but we're hearing a little bit of music in the background. It must be coming through the phone, so we're going to call you back and see if we... Not that it's unpleasant, but I'd rather just hear you.
No, of course. Okay. I'm calling from a landline in a hotel, so I should probably call you back.
Okay. Do you have her number?
I do.
Good.
Thank you. You want me to call you right back?
Would you do that?
Okay, I'll do that right now.
Thank you.
Okay,
yeah.
Bye-bye.
I don't know if I'm hearing music. At first, I thought it was just me hearing music, but I think that Scotty said he heard a little bit of music, and maybe you did too. So we'll try to eliminate that music and return and take phone calls for our guest, who's written a fascinating book, The Industries of the Future. Alec Ross is with us. He's an expert on innovation. He served for 4 years as Hillary Clinton's senior advisor for innovation, and he traveled all over the world and had a chance to look at some of these innovations. He is a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University and serves as advisor to investors, corporations, government leaders. We'll move into what's going to be happening in the healthcare field with enormous, enormous advances in the next 10 years. They're truly astounding. And what's available now and being developed right now is something you'll want to hear about. We'll welcome phone calls as well. Here's how you reach this conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. We've spent a lot of time talking about robots. Can you see a robot in your future as you age and you need help and would prefer that other people not have to wait on you like your children? Would you like to have a robot, and could it be affordable enough to help you bathe, help you get food, help you get to talk to you even? What about robots in the workplace? He talks about the fact that robots are already taking over rather routine jobs like painting, welding, basic assembly, but they can also take over other kinds of jobs. Is that worrisome as we move into a more technologically advanced society? What does it do to the poor among us? What does it do to the wealthy among us? How does it distribute wealth? Who wins and who loses from this? We would love to hear from you. And he'll give you his thoughts on the many different areas that he writes about in his book. Our phone number is 800 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. What will drive the next 20 years of change to our economies and our societies? The key industries that will shape the future: robotics, advanced life sciences, the codification of money, cybersecurity, and big data. To you momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls. We're talking this hour with the author of The Industries of the Future, Alec Ross, is our guest, and we have many more areas to cover, but let's weave some phone calls in right now, and we'll start with Thomas, who's driving through. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. And this is really a comment that supports the gentleman's point. I work for a company that provides technology to keep people home longer, to keep them safe, in addition to technology that monitors someone's vital signs when they're at home, transitioning from the hospital to the home.
Mm-hmm.
And this technology is already there, and it's a huge driving factor in healthcare today. And the cost itself in the last 4 to 5 years has gone down so significantly, which allows more and more people to use it. But sort of like the future is already here, especially in healthcare, where we're trying to find ways to provide more services, better health, and people keep people safer longer.
And tell me more about those services, Thomas. What do they provide to people who are making the transition?
So some of this is driven by actually Medicare. So the idea is that when people get out of the hospital, where there are certain chronic conditions that bring them back in very quickly, and the cost is very, very high. And with the Affordable Care Act, I'm not taking a position here, but with the Affordable Care Act, it now says hospital, physician, skilled nursing facility, we paid you, we're not paying you again. So you have to create the efficiencies to keep these people safe and home and out of the hospital. And so what that has created is an additional market for technology companies like mine that have the ability to say, okay, we can put this technology in the home for a period of time, so when Mrs. Smith transitions back to home, she doesn't go back in.
Right.
And the cost has come down so significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks to that, not necessarily robotics, but the automation and change in technology that allows us to provide better healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Alec.
So Thomas is describing the industries of the future here. And one of the things that I really like about it is he's there in Wisconsin, Wisconsin company. Not all of this has to come from Silicon Valley. You know, part of what I'm really excited about is during the last stage of innovation and globalization, so many of the companies that built the products and services lived in this 30-mile-long, 15-mile-wide area called Silicon Valley. And a lot of what I write about in the industries of the future is how a lot of the next great companies are going to come from different places. They're going to come from different places in the United States, taking advantage of the tremendous educational resources at places like the University of Wisconsin. And you know, what he described basically takes inefficiency out of the healthcare system. And so this is a perfect example of what's next in healthcare. And we're already beginning to see, we're at the beginning of it now. It's sort of chapter one, page one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call. And in terms of what we'll be seeing in terms of healthcare discoveries, and particularly discoveries of how to pinpoint cancer and the small instruments that will be able to be used to kill cancer cells, you've met with some people who are really on the forefront of some remarkable, remarkable healthcare advances.
That's right. I'm at Johns Hopkins University, which is a very fine institution with a great medical school. And I've been very lucky, very blessed to be able to see the kind of cancer research that's taking place there. And I'd love to tell you, you know, briefly one story from
sure.
the book. You know, I play racquetball. And there's this guy who I thought was sort of a gym rat, you know, sort of in his 60s, kind of gray hair, big old beard all over the place, wears a knee brace on the outside of his 1970s-style great sweatpants and brings his racquetball gear to the gym in a Samsonite suitcase. Turns out this guy is the world's most cited living scientist. It was his team that actually discovered how mutations in proteins cause cancer back in the 1980s. And what his team has developed is something called a liquid biopsy. So when I go to the doctor, and I bet when a lot of our listeners go to the doctor, you get blood drawn, and they tell you what your cholesterol level is and things like this. Well, they have figured out, using the genetic material in our blood, you can detect cancer at 1/100th the size of what can be detected by an MRI.
Mm.
And what this means is that cancers that are routinely found in stages 3 and 4, we are going to be able to find early in stage 1. And, you know, this is a game changer. I mean, this is the kind of thing that can add a couple years of life expectancy to all of our lives, being able to identify cancers when they're much more treatable than when they're in stages 3 or 4. You know, this is the promise of genetics that has been long hoped for. We're now about 15 years past the first time where we mapped the human genome. The first time a human genome was mapped, it cost $2.7 billion. What cost $2.7 billion 15 years ago? 5 years ago, it cost $100,000. Today, it costs about $2,000. So it's still too expensive, Kathleen, for all of us to go out and get our genomes sequenced, to give our doctors, you know, a lot of raw genetic material. But it was $100,000 5 years ago, and it's $2,000 now. What that means is that with the price going down, down, down like this, we're going to be able to take some of these really advanced therapies that extremely wealthy people are benefiting from now, and it'll be able to get to, you know, middle-class folks like me within the next couple of years.
Mm. So do you think that there will be cancer 10 years from now?
I think that there will be cancer 10 years from now. But what I think is that for a bunch of different kinds of cancer, the kill rates, the fatality rates will go way down. You know, so I think about acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL. When adults get ALL, it tends to be fatal. But, you know, one of the stories that I tell in the industries of the future is about how the University of Washington in St. Louis, some breakthroughs that they made, again, studying the genetics of leukemia, of ALL, how suddenly that went from being something that is almost untreatable to adults to being something that you can survive. So in 10 years, I think that there will be cancer, but I think that in developed economies, like our American economy, there will be a bunch of different kinds of cancer that don't kill us as often. Mm. I think we'll live longer lives.
Mm-hmm. We go to Bob in Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, Bob, you?
Good.
Good. Go right ahead, sir.
The issue that I'd like to talk about is doubling of information. I retired from the healthcare industry about 13 years ago, and I'm old enough to have experienced the IBM's electric typewriter, the fax machine, internet, and now the cell phone or the smartphone. My query is when I was younger, information doubled about every 5 years. I understand now that information is doubling in a matter of seconds.
Hmm.
Could your speaker comment on that, please?
Sure. So this is insane, Bob. Land was the raw material of the agricultural age. Iron was the raw material of the industrial age. Data, information, is the raw material of the information age. 90% of the world's data has been produced in the last 2 years. To your point, to the caller's point, the amount of information that was produced from the days of cavemen, so paintings on cave walls, until the year 2013, take the sum of the information produced from the first drawings on cave walls to the year 2003, we now produce that amount of information every 2 days. So we've created a Pacific Ocean worth of information. and the industries of the future in significant measure will figure out how to take a Pacific Ocean worth of information and not drown in it, but draw meaning out of it. So, for example, we were talking about cancer a while ago. The amount of information we can draw out of our body's 25,000 genes is far greater today than it was previously. What are we going to do with that genetic information? We're going to be able to diagnose cancer earlier. We're going to be able to develop new drugs. So Bob's point about the doubling of information happening at a near constant rate now is completely accurate, and it's the foundation in many respects for the industries of the future.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Bob, for your call. Let's talk about language for just a moment and the language barrier about to fall. You talk, and many of us are familiar with this, about taking a pocket dictionary. You've traveled all over the world with the Secretary of State looking at innovation. But now what's going to be happening is that we can converse in dozens of foreign languages. And if you have a dinner party with people having seven different languages at the table, you can hear what they're saying in their own voice, and they can hear what you're saying in their language?
So this is one of my... So look, my book, The Industries of the Future, I would say it is a realistic book. It's maybe an idealistic realistic book, but this prediction of mine, which I do believe is true, is one that's a little bit out there, but I can see the foundations for it taking place. What I think is that the developments that are taking place in hardware right now are going to allow us to put earbuds in our ears or an earpiece in our ear. And when somebody speaks to us in a language that we don't understand, the microphone on our mobile phones will pick up their voice, will translate it,
wow,
and we'll hear the voice. We will hear the language we want to hear in our ear as the person speaking a foreign language is speaking it to us. And what's more, instead of it being in Siri's voice, instead of it sounding like a computer's voice, because of advances in bioacoustic engineering, measuring the wavelength, sound intensity, and other properties of a voice, as a person is speaking a language to us that we don't understand, not only will we hear it in English, but we'll hear it in a rough approximation to what the speaker's real voice sounds like.
Mm. And what industries are driving that technology? Is it defense industry? Is it because we need to figure out what people we don't like very much are saying?
That's exactly right. So if you think about it, the NSA, we all know because of Edward Snowden now what the remarkable capabilities of the NSA is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to listen to telephone traffic from all over the world and be able to translate it from, you know, dozens of different languages into English to be able to identify terrorist threats. So the NSA is an example of the kind of place where some of this innovation is taking place. And interestingly, so is Google. So when I was, you know, when I was a little kid and I'd leave the country, as you mentioned, I'd take a pocket dictionary with me and it'd take me like 5 minutes to put together a sentence.
Right. Right.
Now there's Google Translate. So now I've got an iPhone, and I'll like type into the iPhone the sentence that I wanna be able to say, and into Google Translate on my phone, and it'll come back. So the question really is it somebody like Google who develops this, working with a company, or maybe a company like Apple that does such a great job at developing hardware, or is it an entirely new startup? Maybe that comes from a former employee of the NSA. I'm seeing lots of examples of attempts at both.
Mm.
I know what Google is trying to do, and I write about it in the book. And because of my experience working at the State Department, I had close relationships at the NSA, and so I know a lot of what's being developed there as well.
Fascinating. I was late to Siri. I still don't even, I can't figure out. Every time I use Siri, I think, how can I do this? What's going on here? This is amazing. Siri,
yeah,
I want to get up at 8 o'clock. Yeah.
Yeah, you know who's a lot better at Siri than I am is my 11-year-old daughter and my
9 and 11-year-old
son.
Don't you hate it? I know.
Well, no, you know, I'm not a Siri person, but my I hear Siri's voice all over my house because my daughter gets a kick out of it.
Yeah, I get a kick out of it, too. It's just that technology is just amazing to me. Isn't
well,
it to
it,
you?
It is. And it's going to keep changing faster. I mean, these things that we thought were ridiculous a handful of years ago are now becoming real. And what's disorienting, it's disorienting in both a good way and in a slightly scary way, is that the change is coming faster and faster and faster.
Right.
You know, I was at I'm in Silicon Valley right now, and I was at a dinner last night, and a young Chinese man and a young Chinese woman came up to me, and they showed me, you know, using their Chinese cell phone, some of the things that they were doing with voice recognition, and it was crazy. So he would, like, say to his phone, "Tell me where the closest sushi restaurants are." And a map, without his having touched the phone, a map jumps up on his phone and shows him where they are. And so this is the kind of stuff that was science fiction,
yes,
10 years ago, but it's becoming reality now.
Yes. Let's go to Brian in Fond du Lac next. Hello, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing today? What a wonderful program.
Thanks.
I tuned in, unfortunately, a little bit late, but I wanted to comment and get some feedback from your guest, Kathleen, about the development of the gene editing programs such as CRISPR-Cas9 drive and some of those things that are really remarkable. I contend with some of my friends that this gene editing program is probably bigger than computers in some ways. It absolutely amazes me, and it amazes me in both ways. The wonders that could be done and evil could be done. I just saw in the news the other day that the British government okayed embryonic research of week-old embryos that would, you know, be ended from it, and it was really quite amazing to me the potentiality of this to end cancers, diseases, birth defects. I'd like to hear something from your guest about this. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
I'm so glad you brought this up. And this is a case where, again, my book it tries to point out the good and the bad. And in responding to you, sir, I'm going to try to point out the good and the bad. So the world's last trillion-dollar industry was created out of computer code. The world's next trillion-dollar industry is going to be created out of genetic code. And so the caller referenced something called CRISPR. And what this is it means we can actually splice, we can cut our genetic material to be able to account for defects or to fix our genetic programming. Okay? Now, let's think about what's good about this. What's good about this is it could help us address malfunctioning genes that might give us chronic diseases like Huntington's or acute diseases like Huntington's or, you know, cancer and other things. But let's point out a dark side for a second, too. And this hadn't occurred to me until a genetic doctor at Johns Hopkins explained it to me. Designer babies.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, like my wife and I had three children, and you know, right now, you can't. A doctor can tell you if you want, you know, oh, you know, while the woman is still pregnant, oh, it's going to be a little boy, oh, it's going to be a little girl. Now, my wife and I took a genetic test that is normal now, and basically, what it does is it measures the possibility of the baby having Down syndrome. And with that information, parents can make choices about whether the baby is brought to term. So most pregnancies in America, you take this genetic test. What's scary, Kathleen, is that the advances that the caller mentions will point out, oh yes, you know, it's a boy. The boy will have brown hair and will be probably between 5'6" and 5'8". He'll have a 13% chance of getting Parkinson's.
Goodness.
He'll have an 11% chance of being an alcoholic. He'll have an 8% chance of this, a 6% chance of that. So all of this crazy information based on our genes will suddenly be given to parents. And what I worry is, first of all, about parents making choices about what babies they decide to bring to term,
mm-hmm,
based on that information.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a little scary to me to think about the CRISPR technology, which the caller referenced, which allows us to genetically splice things. So, yes, it can address illnesses. But what if we say, oh, my son is only going to be 5'5"? I sure would like for him to be taller.
Mm-hmm.
And then you modify the genetic material. So this is where I think we have to have both eyes open. And as the technology advances, as the science advances, we have to assert our human values over the science and over the technology. Mm.
It's hard to imagine stopping that, though, isn't it, Alec? I could easily see 20 or 30 years from now where people are deciding what they want to have, and we'll create such children.
You can't slow down technological and scientific progress. What you can do is govern it. And what you can do is assert a series of values over it. Like we did this with nuclear power. We've done this with other technologies in the past. You know, what we have to do is figure out what choices do we want as a society. I'm not saying what the right answer is, and I'm not saying what the wrong answer is. What I'm saying is I would like for humans to make these decisions instead of machines.
Yeah, we can go too far, that's for sure. Alec Ross is our guest this hour. Alec is the author of The Industries of the Future, which is a fascinating book that looks at the future key industries. He concentrates on robotics, advanced life sciences, the codification of money, which we have yet to get to, cybersecurity, and big data. He is now a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He's a leading expert on innovation. He served for 4 years as senior advisor for innovation to the Secretary of State and now is an advisor to investors, corporations, and government leaders. And he's traveled all over the world. Some of the innovations we're seeing are found in countries that aren't flourishing necessarily, that aren't huge economies in the world. So we'll talk about where he's seeing things that you wouldn't quite expect. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Alec Ross is our guest this hour, The Industries of the Future, his book, and we go to Alan next in Grant County. Hi, Alan.
Thank you, Kathleen. I'd like to ask Alex about what kind of robots will we develop that will address human overpopulation of the planet, ecological degradation, species extinction, depletion of the ocean's resources, and all of the environmental issues that are going to face this as a species in the future if we continue on the route we're on.
Well, I'll tell you, Alan, I don't know that there's a robotic solution to those challenges. What I think is that there's got to be a human addressing those challenges. You know, I think that, you know, when you talk, for example, about the ecological ruin that we are making of much of the planet, there's another section of the book about big data where, you know, one of the things that I describe is how farmers are growing increasingly more sophisticated in the analytics that they use when they're farming so that they don't over-fertilize the field, so that we don't get nitrogen spillover into our waterways the way in which has happened in the past. So, you know, look, I think that robotics is going to address a lot of challenges. I think that they're going to contribute to the promise and the peril of our past, but I don't think they're going to take over everything. And some of the kinds of challenges that you mentioned related to overpopulation and other such things, I don't see the responsibility for that shifting from human beings to robots anytime soon.
Thank you so much for your call. And we go to Ray in Milwaukee next. Hello, Ray.
I want to talk about the dark side of what we're speaking of here. The gentleman who runs Tesla Motors, who's a genius, basically, Elon Gulan, whatever his name is, he just recently, maybe in the last month or two, came out with a statement about artificial intelligence, and he is absolutely terrified by it because we're moving into a world where in Egypt, in Syria, in Libya, when the Arab uprising happened, all these people over there who thought they were safe started tweeting, you know, throw down the government, get rid of the government. And when all of a sudden the military was running the government there, they just went to those accounts and were easily able to go and take those people who are now dissidents to the government and lock them up and throw away the key. Imagine our country here. All the twittering and tweeting about this election. What if Ted Cruz or Donald Trump is the president and he decides, well, I want to round up the lefties maybe we're going to put them in one state. And you just were speaking about people not needing to learn foreign languages. Well, it's a known fact that if you raise your child and teach that child more than one language, you're increasing their brain by, you know, I don't know what percentage, but you're giving them a big boost up because they're bilingual or trilingual.
Right.
So I don't see this technology, you know, people want to say it's wonderful, you know, everybody should be on the internet. Nowadays, more people are dying in car accidents because of people texting than there are drunk drivers. And we're in Wisconsin, where drunk driving is a daily, you know, almost every night someone's going the wrong way on the highway here. But do we really want to give ourselves up to the digital age? To me, it's absolutely terrifying. And
all right, let me hold you there. We have a lot of calls. Thank you, Ray, though. Alec.
Yeah, so what I will feed the caller made a number of points. Let me respond to one of them. He said he mentioned learning languages. So in my book, I describe how, you know, the device that I described earlier in our show here, how we'll be able to hear the voice that we want to hear as opposed to a foreign language that we don't understand. The last chapter of the book is called The Most Important Job You'll Ever Have. Now, the most important job you'll ever have is being a parent. And one of the points that I actually make in that chapter goes directly to the caller's point, that if we do teach our children foreign languages, it does have an enormously positive impact in terms of their neurological development. It also, oh, by the way, regardless of whatever kind of earpieces we do put in our ears, will help them become better international business people, if that's what they choose to be. His overall point about whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic, I understand that he is looking at technological development very pessimistically. The way that I think is the most responsible way to view it is not so much optimistic or pessimistic as it is realistic and saying, all right, which way are these technologies going? What are the choices we are going to make as parents? What are the choices we're going to make as citizens about how we use these technologies and to what end we're going to use them?
Thanks, Ray, for your call. Mario in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I am 33 years old. I'm a gay male. And we've gone, I'm married now to my husband. And we wanted to have children. And thanks to the advances in science, we were able to have a baby girl. We had an egg. We used an egg donor and a surrogate. But before we started the whole process, we didn't know how advanced this whole science process was. You know, our egg donor was tested for genetic testing. It was sent to a special lab to make sure that she didn't have any genetic abnormalities. So was I and my husband. And then after that, we created embryos, which were then all tested for Down syndrome, for a genetic, you know, certain genetic disorders. And then we obviously found out whether they were a boy or girl. And then from after we knew all this information, then we transferred the desirable embryo, which then are graded, to our surrogate. And then we ended up now we have a six-month-old baby. And I don't consider like a designer baby, but rather we were looking to minimize the risk of this child potentially having life-threatening diseases in the future.
Right.
That would be hard for not only her, but for us as well. So I'm optimistic. I am. We have benefited from science. And for that, I'm grateful. And not only that, but there was all these jobs created through this sector, right? There was embryologists, there were scientists, researchers, there was like agencies. There was like a huge entire sector that we didn't know, and they're all kind of benefiting from the science. And then, of course, we are as well.
And was it expensive for you, Mario?
You know, it was kind of expensive. The whole process for us ended up costing about $100,000.
Oh, yeah.
I say it's a little bit expensive, but it's, you know, not. I mean, I'm sure in the future all this will be reduced costs. You know, a lot of the costs also we incur was because we decided to do genetic testing on a lot of the embryos and genetic testing on the
right.
donor and everything else. And those tests, well, I thought they were expensive. I didn't think they were radically out of reach. For example, the genetic testing for the embryos. All in total cost $4,000,
mm-hmm.
which is, for us, it was worth it to do these tests on the embryos prior to transfer, and we'd rather pay that now and to sort of minimize the risk of having a child with Down syndrome or other
right.
life-threatening diseases.
Yeah, well, congratulations. Are you getting any sleep?
Thank you.
Getting any sleep at night, Mario?
No, actually, right now we're not because our daughter is teething.
Right.
Yeah. So we didn't. We were trying to reduce that by genetic testing, but it didn't work.
Right.
But yeah. So she's teething. So we're like not sleeping pretty much right now. But beyond that, we are the happiest of dads.
Yeah, I can hear that, Alec.
So this look, we've been talking about ideas, Kathleen, and what Mario just told a story of is, you know, he basically just gave a real life example of how what I write about in the industries of the future, how this stuff is actually happening. And so this is, you know, whether you think it's good or whether you think it's bad, I mean, Mario and his husband now have a 6-month-old baby.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he thinks it's very good. This is a glimpse into something that might seem a little crazy to some people now and expensive, $100,000, but which is going to be less crazy and less expensive in the very near future.
Yeah, it's something. Mario, thank you so much for the call. We haven't talked about this money, codification of money. What's that?
Things that we traditionally think of as being controlled by the government, like, you know, money. You know, we put pictures of our presidents on our money, and, you know, if you're in Europe, you put pictures of your king or your queen or your prime minister. But increasingly, a trend that I see is stateless currency. And it's not something we need in the United States because we have a strong currency in the dollar. But when you do look out across the global economy, there are a lot of very weak currencies out there. Moving money around the globe is a complete nightmare. For any of our listeners who do business internationally, they know that they pay enormous fees to move money around the globe. And so one of the next waves of digital innovation, internet innovation, I think, is it's going to make it easier and easier and easier for us to live in a cash-free economy.
Hmm.
And I think one of the things that it's going to do is it's going to take out some of the sort of backwards currencies that are circulating in some countries as they move to all digital currency.
Hmm, interesting. One more call. It has to be brief, almost out of time, but Jacob, it's yours. Hi.
Oh, thanks. Hi. Interesting show. Really great. I came in a little late, but I thought an interesting tidbit I could add is I recently sat next to an Amazon executive, and we had a really interesting conversation on a plane. And one of the things he mentioned was by 2018 how they want to have at least one completely dark warehouse where only robots are doing the sorting. And only humans that will be involved in the warehouse will be technicians with minor headlamps to go work on the robots when they break down. Other than that, completely dark warehouse with nothing but robots inside it.
Hmm.
So that's how the future's going, you know?
Yeah, thanks, Jacob. Alec.
So what is it today? It's Wednesday?
Yes,
so
it is.
On Monday, I was at Amazon in Seattle.
Oh.
Yeah, I was there. I did a book talk at Amazon. Seems appropriate, right?
Sure.
And what Jacob describes is happening. I mean, if people think I'm a little kooky, you know, I promise I'm not somebody living in, you know, not an adult living in his mother's basement watching old movies, that these robots that I describe in the industries of the future are exactly as Jacob describes it. And, you know, I got to see some of this up at Amazon, where they are building these wildly sophisticated facilities. And, you know, look, I've been using Amazon for 20 years, and I remember, you know, back in the day, I'd order something and hope to get it in, you know, a week and a half. Now you get it in like a day.
I know. It's remarkable.
And you can get millions of different things. And this is enabled by robotics from the industries of the future.
Well, I don't think you're kooky at all. I think your book is fascinating. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Alec Ross, our guest. The book is The Industries of the Future. Tomorrow we should have a couple interesting shows. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn will be with us the first hour of the program. We're going to talk about all kinds of issues with him. And hour two of our program, the author of the book, The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. The book is a story of a time in the segregated South, four classmates who came to reconsider the attitudes that they had as they were growing up. So that should be a good discussion as well. That's tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And just a reminder that tomorrow is the presidential Democratic debate, PBS debate. It's here in Milwaukee at the UWM Milwaukee campus, and it's going to be broadcast here on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8 o'clock. Scotty and I will be in the spin room, and we'll let you know what's going on. to the best of our ability tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing the show.